This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. A teaching residency program here in Chattanooga is partnering with a national effort to recruit, develop, and retain Black educators. Project Inspire, run by Chattanooga's Public Education Foundation, is participating in the Black Educators Initiative through the National Center for Teacher Residencies. Mark Neal is the director of Project Inspire. Jonathan Brown is a Project Inspire alum, and he now teaches first grade at Orchard Knob Elementary School. Mark, Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ray.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Tell us more about this initiative.
The Black Educator Initiative, which is a national initiative funded by a group called the Ballmer Group, operated by our partners at the National Center for Teacher Residencies. And that's a group of about 30 teacher residency programs, similar to Project Inspire here in Chattanooga. And we're all working together to increase the recruitment and retention of Black educators.
Most people listening to us know why that's important, but just if you would, please, both of you, drive home from your experience as educators, how and why it is so important.
One of the first points we always want to make about diversity in general is that it is an asset, both within the school culture and for students and for any group of teachers. And I myself come from a biology, ecology background. So that's just a fundamental aspect of diversity in itself. But within education, there's a lot of emerging research showing that the presence of educators of color drives improvements in achievement for all students. And we also know that students are able to achieve better long-term outcomes in terms of graduation and going on to college when they have that exposure to a diverse and to a teacher of color along the way. But ultimately, here in Hamilton County, we also have to think about students being able to really see themselves in the teaching profession. And so with a student population that is north of 40% in terms of students of color, and I know currently the number of teachers of color is hovering around 10, 11, 12%. So quite a mismatch there that we're hoping through this work to, and really with a lot of strategic partners across the community, and Hamilton County Schools being a real leader and acknowledging the need for improvement there. So that's the big goal, is to get a better balance among the teaching force that's going to look more like and represent the students that are in our community.
It benefits not only students of color, but that of their white counterparts as well. I think looking at the data, if you look at it, it shows that students who have teachers of color are more culturally aware, but also willing to have those cultural conversations because they're willing and in spaces that allow them to have that comfort because they have a teacher of color in front of them. So it's easy to recruit. As we always say, you can get Black teachers, but the hardest part is retaining them once they're there. And through this initiative, it allows us to keep these great teachers in front of these students, because the more great teachers that a student has in their lifetime, the more likely they are to go on and do great things. It's really significant because, I mean, I can even pinpoint it personally here. My first year as a teacher resident in Project Inspire, I was paired with a Black mentor or a Black lead teacher. So that was dynamic in having a Black woman and a Black male in the classroom. But we had, of that makeup, we had a white student that year. And before, she just never had conversations surrounding like race and just what it means and things like that. So Black History Month was our favorite time of the year. And she comes up to us afterwards and is like, I didn't know how to talk about this. I didn't know in what ways to talk about this. And take it, this is a first grader. She wanted to have the conversation, just didn't know where to start. But because she had two very diverse teachers of colors in front of her, she felt comfortable enough to have that conversation. And I can only imagine if I caught up with her now, she's currently going to be a third grader, she's going to fourth now. I can see the growth in her and that she has that comfortability now to attack those types of problems. So it benefits all children in the classroom because you're not only putting a great teacher in front of them, you're enabling them with the tools to have these conversations that'll transcend generational conversations and also allow them to be more prepared when they get to that end of the spectrum in high school and college.
Now, this initiative is nationwide. How, where, and when will we start to see its impact here in Hamilton County and in the Chattanooga area?
For us at Project Inspire, this is an opportunity to implement some research-based interventions in terms of recruiting and retaining Black educators. So specifically here in Hamilton County, we are going to be able to launch a couple of new ideas within the Project Inspire residency test them out, pilot them with the hope of scaling them through our partnership with Hamilton County Schools. A couple of those ideas are, first, one-to-one mentorship from an existing Black educator to a Black resident who is training within Project Inspire. And just as a reminder, these are folks who did not study education, but have a college degree and are seeking to gain that training to become a teacher. And Project Inspire offers that through a 14-month experience. So that's one that we're really excited about. And we provide what's called a clinical instructor that Jonathan mentioned. That's exactly what the name implies. That's your host teacher who's teaching you how to teach. But this idea of mentorship's a little bit different, right? Someone who has walked the walk and understands what it means to be a Black educator here in Chattanooga, and an outstanding one, which Jonathan is a great example, as he's already shown you through his work. So that's one idea, is that idea of that mentor, because any professional listening to this understands that they've been able to get where they are through that mentorship as much as anything. And then a second idea we're really excited about, which we see as a larger magnet, I think, to attract potential candidates into teaching and really to strengthen their long-term retention. And this is the idea of a pre-residency internship. And all of these are, as all great ideas are, borrowed from our colleagues in education. But the pre-residency internship would be a hybrid sort of in-person and remote opportunity for someone in the spring of 2022 to really have a mock experience of the residency, to spend 2 or 3 days working beside someone like Jonathan in the school, beginning to engage in some of the coursework we offer, beginning to engage in some of the critical conversations that we have within the residency, and all of that to really improve that sense of fit, that this is where a person wants to be, this is where they want to make their difference, so that they're not really testing that out in front of kids. We're really excited about that pre-residency internship. And all of this that I've just mentioned is going to require a significant amount of community partnership, like I said, both with Hamilton County Schools, but really with churches, community groups. I mean, everyone that has reach across our community. Again, we're testing some pilot things on a small scale, but this is ultimately about broader scale, because Hamilton County Schools, as I said, has really embraced that idea of long-term improvement of recruitment and retention of Black educators, and really all educators of color. So again, you know, the funding supporting this work around Black educators, but we see this as an opportunity to think about teacher diversity at a larger scale.
And I would just add to one thing that it's already been started, but it will be further improved upon, is we have affinity groups within Project Inspire. So this would allow us to further target in those Black educators and create a more formalized space in which we can have programming, just gatherings around time, and allow that space to be created, but also make sure we're doing specific key pinpointed programming for those Black teachers, checking in at times during the year, seeing what they need, and going back through and using that funding to help make sure that we're providing those spaces or the learning or the conversations or the facilitators to give them exactly what they need at that moment in order to help make sure that we're improving that retention. Because as you know, when you come in a cohort with anything, if you can stay with that cohort and stay bonded with them through your years, you're more likely to finish, as seen through college programs and scholarships and things like that. So just trying to, again, like Mark said, taking that idea, turning it into our own, further expanding on those affinity groups and making sure we're strengthening those bonds across the generations or the multiple cohorts of Project Inspire Black alums that we have.
What will you have to keep in mind as you develop and implement these pilot programs, given the experience of the past year, in particular for teachers of color, such as yourself, Jonathan, and for students of color?
The biggest thing, and we kind of alluded to it, but making it more formal, is, as you see with the funding, we've talked about it a little bit, but it's not set in stone, so to say. It allows us this freedom to actually intentionally reach out to our Black educators and say, hey, what do you need from us? How can we come alongside you? How can we support you? And as Mark talked about, it's not just Project Inspire or PEF coming through and saying, we're going to do this alone. It's how can we bring the community together with you? Because I think especially being a Black teacher this past year and teaching Black and Brown students, the biggest thing is that's helped make it through this year has been the community support, has been people coming in and not saying you need to do this, but instead asking me, what can I do for you to help you make it through this year, and coming alongside me and working with me. So I think that's what's the biggest thing that's going to help push this forward and make it a more permanent thing based off of the last year teaching through a pandemic and adjusting on a daily, sometimes minute by minute basis, is using this funding, as we've already outlined and laid out, to come through and say, this is what we have in mind, but it's not concrete. But these are the formal structures that can help give you what you need. You just have to tell us and we'll take it, we'll retool, and we'll come back and make it exactly what you need over the next year.
Jonathan is speaking to an important aspect of teaching that Project Inspire has emphasized and supported even prior to the pandemic and throughout its existence, which is this notion of being a culturally responsive teacher. And as Jonathan spoke, you know, I really think about the social and emotional aspects of kids returning, you know, and families returning full time to school, many from what has been a traumatic experience on top of potentially, you know, other trauma in their lives. So what Jonathan said is powerful in terms of being an educator who is culturally responsive and listening to the community and not trying to impose a scripted curriculum upon groups of students and families. It really does start with listening to what those social and emotional and cultural needs are from the community. And educators have really delivered on that need. We've heard the thanks and just came off Teacher Appreciation Week. I hope that thanks continues to resonate through this community as we restart school next year, because we really have a great opportunity to, as Jonathan said, listen to educators who are listening to the community. And that is just a really powerful piece of Project Inspire. We reemphasize continuously in this program.
And where can people go online to keep up on all the progress?
They can visit Project Inspire's website, projectinspiretn.org. We're also a part of the Public Education Foundation. Chattanooga, pefchattanooga.org is a chance to learn about the broader work of PEF in partnership with Hamilton County Schools.
All right, Mark, Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
A week from tomorrow, Signal Centers here in Chattanooga hosts its annual Accessibility Awareness Summit. The virtual event will take place at Chattanooga State Community College. Marge Fleming of LaunchPoint Leadership and Jeff Milliner of the Enterprise Center tell us more.
Marge, Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Ray. So happy to be here.
Happy to be here, yes.
Tell us more about Signal Center's mission.
Their mission is to serve to strengthen children, adults, and families through services focusing on disabilities, early childhood education, and self-sufficiency. They foster lifelong independence for children and families and adults.
And I would say Signal Centers is one of those nonprofits in Chattanooga who, the more you look into great work happening here, the more you're going to see their involvement. Just one of those foundational partners involved in so much in making our community a more accessible and equitable place.
And this year, the Accessibility Awareness Summit, the keynote presenter, Chris Downey.
Well, Chris Downey was an established business owner with an architect firm in San Francisco who developed a brain tumor. They operated, and when he came out of that, he was blind. And so he had to essentially pivot both his business and his career. And he has gone in the direction of the spaces that people need to function in their everyday life. And so he's still in architecture. He does a little bit of speaking, but he mainly is a business owner that has changed the way he thinks about living and working space.
Chris really brings this incredible lens of both, as Marge said, kind of innovation in architecture, one of the few practicing blind architects, as well as kind of our built environment, these spaces, thinking about not just accessibility in terms of ramps, but also in terms of the acoustics, auditory experiences, tactile experiences, the layouts of buildings. And it's really exciting for us to have somebody who's had such an incredible career bring such expertise to think about our physical spaces in our community, about what it means to live in an accessible community, the directions that we can take that energy driving the development of the innovation district, kind of all the energy and excitement in Chattanooga at the moment. He's a perfect, perfect speaker to kick this off.
What's one example of his work reflecting what he had experienced in life?
Well, he's worked with the Department of Veteran Affairs at their blind rehab center. He's done a number of renovations on housing for the blind, in terms of the architecture, of course, for housing for the blind. And he's also worked at the Transbay Transit Center in San Francisco. And in addition to that, he actually teaches accessibility and universal design at UC Berkeley. So he's done a pretty wide variety of things, taking advantage of his own personal new knowledge of what space has to be like for people with disabilities.
I think particularly his work around transit and this transit center, public transportation, you know, that's a hot button issue for Chattanooga as we grow, certainly other communities around the Southeast, and thinking about, again, how we navigate these spaces, not just sort of inhabit them.
And another thing to navigate when we talk about accessibility is aging.
Yes. And we have incorporated that into our program, well, in a couple of ways. One is we have a roundtable discussion that actually Jeff is going to be facilitating for us that deals with aging and accessibility. And Chris Downey speaks right before that. The keynote is right before that. And we're going to transition him right into that discussion as well. So we're addressing that. That's a really vital part of what is being done and what needs to be done in terms of accessibility and lifelong accessibility, because all of us are aging.
One other thing that I would add there is this past year, the experience of the pandemic, the isolation, we have seen how important digital accessibility is for our entire population, and particularly when we think about those who are aging, our older residents, access to healthcare, staying safe in the middle of the pandemic, but also kind of as we move forward, these layers of connectedness, of staying connected to families, to resources, to entertainment, to quality of life, to kind of all of the opportunities, things like our public library offer purely online. That's a big piece of this accessibility work. The other side of it too is when we think about aging-friendly communities, we may think about the benefits for those who are aging. If we think about the benefits for us living in more diverse communities, intergenerational learning, not distancing ourselves from our elders, but having these opportunities to share in their experiences is huge. And we're really excited to showcase both sides of that in this panel and throughout the event.
And another guest is an activist and athlete who will share her own story about personal accessibility.
Yes, her name is Mia Ives Rubley, and she is a disabled transracial adoptee who works, has really dedicated a lot of time to activism around civil rights and independence in communities. She did organize the original Women's March on Washington in 2017, and she, in many instances, speaks on a national stage for the rights of disabled people and immigrants and other marginalized communities as well. We are very excited to have her as well. She's got a real story to tell, and she's very good at telling it.
And that brings us to another speaker on the changing reality of disability in America.
Yeah, this is a woman out of Boston. Her name is Valerie Fletcher. She is very dynamic. The organization that she is with is called the Institute for Human-Centered Design, and they started out doing masterful work in universal design. And then they kind of moved it around a little bit and changed it to human-centered design. And she has got so much experience, especially in the state of Massachusetts, with what they're doing throughout the state. They are doing work in Japan. They're doing work with the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs. She has got a wealth of experience and a wealth of information. And she talks some about people who identify themselves as disabled, and then the large percentage of people in our country especially, but probably in the world, who are aging and do have disabilities and somehow don't want to identify in that way. And so she talks about how they reach down into that with both research and action. And actually, they get a number of grants to do some of that work and help think on a very broad level about what types of all the types of disabilities people have, and then what to do about them and for them. So her kind of buzzwords are human-centered design and adaptive environments.
What's really, really exciting for us too is, in addition to having this national and international leadership here for the conference, Chattanooga is putting a flag in the ground about being a leader in this space as well, and being able to showcase our local leaders, some of the incredible work that's happening in Southeast Tennessee, and particularly in Chattanooga, on a nonprofit level, in government, and from our private companies, really, again, leading the way. We feel Chattanooga is the perfect place for a conversation like this and to showcase both those kinds of leadership.
And where can people go online to register for the event?
Folks are going to be able to register for the event directly at Signal Center's website. It's just signalcenters.org.
All right. Jeff, Marge, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest is Flynn Berry, whose third novel, Northern Spy, has just been published. Flynn's family are all of Irish descent, and she has spent a great deal of time in Belfast talking to people about their lives and life in a city still regularly riven by sectarian violence perpetrated by the IRA. At the heart of the novel is the paradox of an organization whose goals are understandable, even laudable, and yet at the same time, one that operates very much like organized crime. But while the IRA is a central character in the novel, the story is as much about the three women at the center of the story and the impact the fear of imminent violence has on their lives. You're quoted as saying that the reason that you started your first book was because you were frightened. There'd been a murder in the neighborhood, and you and your roommates, who were all female, all felt that you might potentially be victims. Do you still feel that way?
Interesting. I think every book you can only write at that particular time in your life. And I remember at that particular time in my life, I was 26 years old, and I was living in Austin, Texas, and there had been a home invasion murder in our neighborhood, and a young woman had been killed. And I remember just feeling really angry about how myself and my friends and the women I know have been raised to understand that we're not safe if we walk around an area after dark necessarily, or that we should, you know, make sure that we're careful if we're walking to our car in a parking garage late at night. And that kind of just really came to the surface when I was writing Under the Harrow. Now I feel like my fears have kind of shifted. I have two children. I have two small boys, and it feels like motherhood brings a whole other set of kind of worry or protectiveness that's different from what I felt when I was working on Under the Harrow.
I have to say that I assumed you were a mother. The way you write about the little boy, Finn, and his relationship with Tessa, or perhaps more accurately, her relationship with him. There are just details that it would never occur to me to think about until you mentioned them. That he, at one point, empties a whole container of dish soap on the floor. It's the kind of thing that kids do, you know. If you don't have children, oh my God, does this happen all the time? You know, and of course it does, because they're curious and they're just trying to figure the world out. But to go back to the notion of, that's a terrible thought. I think you quoted a statistic that 98% of murders are committed by men. So that, in combination with the notion that the world is a dangerous place for women, seems to entirely inform the story. Tessa, who is the narrator, and her sister Marion, and her mom. First of all, Tessa has a baby, and yet neither she nor Marion nor her mother have a partner. They're all effectively single women, even though they apparently have had a relationship at some point. And there's this sense, almost from the outset, that they live a precarious existence. And at one point, I think it's either Tessa or Marion, says, well, I'm used to trying to figure out what it is that men want to hear. It's almost as if their whole world is prescribed by men, and yet none of them have a particularly, they don't have any kind of satisfying relationship with a man. How much do you think that is the lot of women anywhere, and how much is that specific to young women living in an appalling place like Belfast? I mean, it just, early in the book, you write, a bomb might rip through here in seconds, or tomorrow, or next year, or never. This is a public market in the middle of the city. And as you said, as the poet put it, glass shattering is Belfast confetti. How do people live in a place like that?
Yeah, that phrase, Belfast confetti, it's from a poet who he's describing the kind of glass shards and rubble on the street after a bomb goes off. I guess, I mean, there's so much to talk about already, but in terms of men and women, I did hear a fair amount of women who describe how if they were living in a place like West Belfast, where there's a lot of IRA activity or loyalty at times, their lives would be kind of curtailed by men. And one example that really struck me is that a woman told me that a friend of hers who wanted to leave her husband and have a divorce, but he was in prison for IRA activities, and representatives from the IRA came to her and said, he's going crazy up in that prison, you can't be leaving him, you know, it would be bad for morale, basically. And so she had to stay married. And I heard stories like that over and over again about the small ways that the conflict would shape women's lives in ways that you wouldn't necessarily expect in terms of even their marriages. So I wanted to write about that. And then about that sort of threat level, it's funny because I think I'm 34. I was a teenager when 9/11 happened and lived outside of the city in New York. And so part of me feels kind of familiar with that fear of changing threat levels. I think my generation in particular and the generations under me, we grew up with terrorism and with the political responses to terrorism, which have shaped our society. And so living in a society that feels kind of potentially explosive didn't seem that far away, which is kind of sad. I think Belfast in particular has had a huge amount of sectarian violence, and people have had to really struggle to carry on with normal life in the face of that threat. But I think all of us around the world have had that and to some degree or another.
Yes, I know what you mean. I don't think it's quite the same. I think that one of the aspects of your novel that I found most compelling was this notion that within the kind of, it's not banal exactly, but, you know, everyday life and the things that we all do that we kind of take for granted, ride the bus, go to the market, whatever it is, you know, all of a sudden you can't take any of those things for granted. You never know what's going to happen from one minute to the next. And then, you know, again, there's this portrayal of the IRA as really no different than the mafia, basically organized criminals who make a lot of their funds through investments. So they're like dark side businessmen, you know, funding this ongoing dysfunction, which works in their favor. And I have to say that there's a great deal of confusion on Google as to the time frame in your novel. My understanding of the time frame was that this was immediately before the Good Friday Accords. Is that true?
So the book is set it's actually contemporary or a few years in the future. So I want to write about a kind of alternate existence in which there was a sort of return to sectarian violence, because it seemed like that it's not necessarily the direction that Northern Ireland is going, but since the Good Friday Agreement, there have been well over 100 security-related murders. There have been attacks on police officers. This past week, there has been rioting in Belfast. Over 70 police officers have been injured in that. And so it doesn't feel like the troubles are over. It seems like there's an uneasy peace, and that the vast majority of people want peace, but that the kind of central issue hasn't been resolved yet.
You seem almost prescient, given the coverage in the news late last week of the riots on the streets again, which more than one reporter, for whatever reason, made a point of saying that some of the people involved in the violence were only 12 or 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, that's a generation that's come of age since the Good Friday Accord. There's at least a generation, if we take somebody your age, who have known nothing else but violence,
yeah.
You know, and discord. You know, to be honest, ultimately kind of pointless. It's like, what exactly are you trying to accomplish? And my reading of your novel and the subtext in your novel is there isn't any point to it. It's all just, as you wrote at one point, some people work in the IRA for years with an eye to a trade, an exfiltration. I had to look that up. An escape from occupied territory is what that means. So basically we have these people who create a situation that they then spend much of their life perpetuating with a view to ultimately escaping it. It seems incredibly cynical.
Yeah, well, the whole issue of informing is quite cynical and fascinating, because at one point I read 1 in 4 IRA members during the Troubles was actually an informer and working for the British state. And so then you have this situation where the British state is kind of controlling all of the pieces. They're controlling like chess pieces, basically, and allowing the conflict to go on and get worse. And if they had a high-ranking informer, they would allow that person to, you know, carry out crimes, attacks, even murders, with the goal that it would sort of be to their benefit in the long run to have someone on the inside. So it's this really extraordinary kind of world of betrayal and lies and double identities that I thought was just really right for writing fiction.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a great story. It's kind of hard to summarize it without giving too much away, but let's just say that Tessa is a young woman. She's a reporter. She works for the BBC in Northern Ireland, which makes her in a kind of dual existence right there. She has a little boy who is not very old. He's less than a year old. When she finds out, or at least she's told, that her sister, with whom she's pretty close, is in the IRA. And she's just no way she's going to accept that. It couldn't possibly be true. From that point, there's this, it's almost Hitchcockian, you know, the notion of a person living their life and having no connection with any criminal activity is drawn into criminal activity obviously against their will, but almost kind of, it's incremental. And so what at the outset would seem, that's never going to happen, as the novel goes on, it becomes quite plausible that somebody would want, you know, to get involved with what is effectively what it reminds me of, to be honest with you. The IRA, as much as anything, is exactly the same thing they say about street gangs in New York, that so many young boys join the gang because it's a surrogate family.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your impression of it?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because at a certain level, what the IRA wants is something that's easy to understand and even sympathize with, because the idea of uniting the island of Ireland, not having Northern Ireland be part of the United Kingdom, but to have the island of Ireland standing on its own, seems sort of reasonable. I feel like most people are pretty anti-colonialism at the moment. But then the way that they're going about achieving that goal is, you know, violent and horrific and brutal and murky. And so you have this really complicated moral landscape. And like you said, I think one of the things I found the most interesting was the recruitment process and how it was like a surrogate family for a lot of people, in that you had this group who would die for you, who was, you know, sworn to protect you. And that kind of belonging and love seems really compelling. And I think you can see how it would be hard to turn away from, especially if maybe you grew up somewhere that you felt like you were under siege. You felt like the police and the army were, you know, always one step away from attacking you or taking you away for internment and arresting you without trial. The radicalization process is just not maybe as kind of dark as we would imagine in some ways. And that oftentimes what I heard is that it would begin as a series of small acts of kindness, like buying someone a cup of tea or lending them a book. And then you would be slowly drawn further and further into violent activities.
Yeah, exactly. And the other clever plotting on your part is by having the narrator be someone who is innocent and has a strong family connection with her mom and with her sister. That stands in stark relief to this other sort of faux family that you describe, that at least some of the members of the gang that you feature in the book, and it's hard not to refer to them as a gang because that's exactly how they come across. So you say, okay, well, that kind of makes sense, and I can see why somebody would be drawn to that, one of the members of the IRA that is in your novel grew up in care. So he never had a real family, and he now feels that he has a family, and in fact feels that Tessa's sister feels the same way about him that he feels about her. He really likes her. He would like to have a relationship with her. So that it's as you say, it's like it's unbelievably duplicitous. It's hard to imagine how, but then at the same time, that would appear to be a microcosm of the macro situation in Northern Ireland, where so many people try to live their lives day to day the way the rest of us do, but their lives are constantly prescribed by a low-grade fear and a low-grade possibility at any moment that violence is going to erupt right where they live. Could be next door.
Yeah, and I think it was so normalized, too. I was talking to a woman this week who I had interviewed, and she was mentioning how at one point she was shopping at Castle Court, which is a shopping center, and there was a bomb scare. So there's an announcement over the loudspeaker that there was possibly a bomb in the building and that it needed to be evacuated. And she said nobody stopped shopping. They were so used to it by that point that they just carried on shopping. And I think there's that kind of fatigue, too. If you've lived through so many false alarms, you just get kind of weary of it.
What's your impression of people's psychological state as a result of having lived in a place like that for so long, for in many cases all their lives? When you talk to people, mm-hmm. did you get any sense of them having a kind of a different worldview than those of us who don't live in a situation like that would have?
So there's been some really interesting work that's kind of beginning to be done and, or has been done about the generational trauma and how even for someone who didn't live through the troubles, they can kind of inherit that trauma from their parents. And I do think you see that, like in the riots this past week, how those things have such a long afterlife. If you if you lost someone during the Troubles or if you were at the scene of a bomb, that that doesn't fade away, and it does affect your children as well. And that kind of inherited trauma, I think, is really interesting. But then on the other hand, most of the people I interviewed had such kind of vibrancy and such determination and strength and Black humor, and they just were getting on with their lives. And the women in particular who I interviewed, I just adored and fell completely in love with because they weren't bullied by anyone. And, you know, I was interviewing a woman who writes about organized crime, and she writes about paramilitaries, and she gets death threats all the time, and she just kind of laughs them off and refuses to be cowed by these men. And so I think it's hard to sort of sum up because it's really bright and lively society at the same time as having a very dark shadow side.
It did strike me that the impression that I got from your book is that the majority of people in the IRA are male. Is that true?
Yeah, it's mostly men, but then one thing that I find really interesting is that there have been quite a few women who have served in active service units. I read a book called Bombshell by an academic named Nia Bloom, who wrote about how in the 1970s, as male IRA members were arrested or killed in action, teenage girls and women became recruited to kind of fill in the ranks. And she said that at one point, the most accurate sniper in Belfast was a teenage girl, and that it was the 1970s, so you'd have teenage girls who would hollow out the heels of their platform shoes and fill them with contraband or explosive material and then walk through security police checkpoints. There's also a famous case of teenage girls pushing a bomb into Belfast City Center in a stroller, like hidden inside a stroller, and how you had a fair number of women who would join the IRA and then use their kind of harmlessness or invisibility as women in order to carry out operations.
Yeah, I mean, that plays out in your novel, doesn't it? The suggestion that at one point the two sisters can cross the border from Northern Ireland into the Republic, because nobody would ever think that two women would be terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
That even after all this time, I mean, if we track it from 1969, that's more than 40 years. You'd think by now, mm-hmm. the occupying forces or the soldiers on the border would be hip to that idea that nobody thinks that it would be a woman, that woman would be a terrorist. But in fact, that's the obvious choice, given that so many people still think that way.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because just this year, this past August, there was a huge MI5 sting operation to arrest the leadership of the new IRA, and two of the alleged leaders of the new IRA are women, and they're currently awaiting trial for directing terrorism. And at the bail hearing, the defense lawyer for one of them said, she's a mother and a grandmother, and she has a clear record, and she should be given the benefit of the doubt and released on bail. And the prosecutor said she's a dedicated terrorist. And it's that thing where we can't really decide if a woman can possibly fill both those roles or be capable of both of those things.
Well, if we take Marion as an example, Marion becomes involved with the IRA because she wants to defeat them, and she considers that being on the inside is the easiest way to bring them down. Do you think that's the motivation for women when they join the IRA or not? They're just like the men. They just are angry at British occupation of their home, understandably, and they just want the Brits out of their home.
Yeah, that does seem to be the case, and there are a few women like Martina Anderson, who's a politician now, but who served time for explosive charges, who have described how they were radicalized by political violence and discrimination against Catholics, and that they did join for the same reason as the men around them, which was to unite the island of Ireland. And some of them even continued to have double lives as IRA members after they had children, and said that they thought it almost as a responsibility to their children to try to bring about a better and peaceful society, and that they felt like this was sort of the end of a conflict that had lasted for centuries. And like, if they could just bring it to a close now, then their children would live in peace. And you can see how seductive that line of reasoning could be for someone who grew up in a place that felt really riven with discrimination and inequality.
But at the same time, it does seem as if your novel is of a piece with everything you've written, and at least in part, you know, informed by that same notion that women live their lives threatened by male violence.
Yes. Yeah, I do think that. I think it's such a strange fact of life. In London recently, there was a murder of a young woman, and one of the responses as part of the sort of general outrage was someone suggested that men should have a curfew, that they shouldn't be allowed out after a certain... And all the men were outraged and were saying, you know, I haven't done anything wrong, why should I have to do that? And women's response was, we haven't done anything wrong, and we've had our own curfews all of our lives. Like, the women that I know make very careful decisions about if they will get in a taxi, they might call someone to let them know that they're on their way in case, you know, the driver turns out to be someone violent, or women won't often, you know, walk their dogs at 11:30 at night. Whereas men don't have that same sort of constant check of fear or threat. And it is, when you look at it that way, when you look at something like a suggestion that men should have a curfew and not be allowed out after a certain time, it does make you realize how kind of insane that kind of fear is for so many women.
God, how long are we going to live with this double standard? And then, right at the end of the book, Tessa jumps up in the air and says, peace. She doesn't necessarily mean an end of the conflict in Northern Ireland as much as perhaps the conflict between the genders.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think the whole book is about that sort of question of how far would you go for peace and what would you do for peace? And I think particularly interesting when you have children involved, because it does change the stakes of it. It does change how you might act and what you would risk of yourself. And I think it's part of just raising a child is living alongside that kind of worry about, will they be safe? Am I doing enough to protect them? I had read that your amygdala, which is the part of your brain that controls fear, actually grows when you're pregnant, and then it never shrinks back down to its normal size. So you just constantly have that heightened vigilance. And so that was something that I definitely wanted to write about and work out for my own sake, partly as well.
Well, the other irony is that, of course, is that Tessa is bringing up a boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thought of that. It's interesting. I do think that we do seem to be at a turning point, possibly, where I doubt that the next generation of boys will be quite the same as what's gone before. It seems like there has been a kind of maybe watershed moment with looking at violence against women and trying to raise boys who are different.
We can only hope.
Yeah.
Thank you for the book. I really enjoy reading it. It's just beautifully plotted and beautifully written. I find the whole thing inexplicable. It's just, but I think your book goes some way to explaining it. And it's, the IRA is invested in maintaining this imbalance while at the same time professing to combat it. I think that's really dispiriting. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, as you say, the solution to the problem is not fighting the IRA. It's improving conditions for people living in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
I could talk to you for hours. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for such a thoughtful interview.
Flynn Berry's third novel, set in Northern Ireland in Belfast, is called Northern Spy. It's just been published. On listener-supported public radio, this is Scenic Roots.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga.
Email us at scenicroutes423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroutes423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.